Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2009, U.S. Ambassador Stephen Sesh in Yemen sent a cable to the United States State Department in Washington saying, quote, water shortages have led desperate people to take desperate measures with equally desperate consequences, end quote. Yemen's aquifers were running dry and residents were erecting roadblocks in protest. The country's Minister of Water said their water shortage was the biggest threat to social stability in the near future. The Center for Investigative Reporting recently got its hands on classified U.S. cables about the global water crisis, and some of them read like diary entries from an apocalyptic sci-fi novel. They reveal mounting alarm by global political and business leaders that water shortages could spark unrest across the world. We're already seeing it in Yemen and Syria, and those water shortages are spreading to the United States. CIR also reports that in private, Nestle, the world's largest food company, told U.S. officials that the world is on a collision course of doom because Americans eat too much meat. Nestle says that if the rest of the world ate like Americans, the planet would have run out of fresh water 15 years ago. A recent study published in the journal Sciences Advances says risks of water shortages are even worse than scientists had previously thought. About 4 billion people, or 66% of the world's population, do not have sufficient access to fresh water for at least 1 month of the year. And this is not just happening overseas, it's also happening in California. In parts of Southern California, people are relying on bottled water because their wells have run dry. So today we are talking about global water shortages and how this should be dealt with. There are solutions, but who has the political will to implement them? Today we're joined by Nathan Halverson. He's an Emmy Award-winning reporter and producer for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, where he covers business and finance with an emphasis on the global food system. And Nathan joins me in studio. Hi, Nathan. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Noah Diffenbaugh, Associate Professor at Stanford University. Noah studies the climate system, including impacts on agriculture, water resources, and human health. Noah is currently editor-in-chief of Geophysical Research Letters, and he has served as an IPCC lead author. And Noah joins us on the line from Stanford. Hi, Noah. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Nathan, your latest series of pieces on the global water crisis are really shocking. Let's first talk about the cables that you got your hands on. These are classified U.S. cables about the global water crisis. First of all, how did you get these cables?
These were part of the cache of documents that were released in 2010 with the WikiLeaks. And so they had been sitting out there in the public domain unlooked at for the last 6 years. And as I've begun digging deeper and deeper into the consequences of water shortages, I thought, well, I wonder if there's anything in there from these countries where, because Yemen is projected to be the first country to completely run out of groundwater. Some projections have it running out next year. And so when that begins to happen, it leads to a lot of instability, a lot of political pressure. And I thought, well, I wonder if there's anything in there in the cables.
And so you found a lot.
A lot.
You write that in 2009, Yemen's water minister warned the U.S. ambassador that water riots were a sign of the future. Quote, less than 2 years later, rural tribesmen fought their way into Yemen's capital, Sana'a, and seized two buildings, the headquarters of the ruling General People's Congress and the main offices of the water utility. The president was forced to resign and a new government was formed, but water issues continued to amplify long simmering tensions between religious groups and tribesmen, which eventually led to a full-fledged civil war, end quote.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a primary resource and it's so quintessential to survival that when it begins to run out, it puts tremendous pressure on the society and leads to violent disputes. And there is increasing academic evidence that's coming out both from Yemen, Syria, elsewhere, of the violence that precipitates when a resource as vital as water begins to dwindle away.
Okay, so these cables were between U.S. ambassadors and, for example, a water minister in Yemen. Who else is involved in these conversations?
Well, they've actually begun percolating up to the highest levels of U.S. government. Hillary Clinton, after probably seeing many of these situations, in fact, when she traveled to Yemen, the government there implored her to help with this situation. She requested a U.S. intelligence analysis of the water shortages around the world. And that classified document was produced in 2012. A sort of smaller, briefer, declassified version was released. And, you know, it had some startling things to say about the impacts that water shortage is going to have for our allies and for, you know, peace in general in the world in the coming decades.
Noah, what are your thoughts on these cables? We're not really hearing much about the seriousness of this. I mean, we see water crisis in the in headlines, but when you read the quotes between U.S. diplomats and these officials overseas, I mean, this is really serious.
Well, yeah, I think that the important point here is that in terms of environmental resources and the reliability of environmental resources, the real issue is risk. And, you know, the one analogy is, you know, the tree falling in the woods. You know, if a tree falls in the woods, then no one's there to hear it, doesn't make a sound. And, you know, really, if there's lack of water in the desert and there's nobody there, then that's a very different impact than, you know, if you have you know, social systems that are you know, developed around a particular reliability of water, and then we have extreme events that push those systems you know, towards a threshold. You know, it's not that it's just the amount of water that really has the impact. It's how that physical resource, the availability of that physical resource, the variability of that physical resource, how that interacts with the natural and human systems that are in that particular place.
Nathan, let's talk about what you learned about Syria. Cables from Syria reveal growing concern about water shortages. In 2008, classified cables from the U.S. Embassy in Damascus to the State Department reveal Syria's UN Food and Agriculture Representative was seeking assistance to deal with the worst drought the country experienced in four decades. Can you talk about what you found there?
Sure. And I think just as a preamble there, what I'll say is that the political instability and really the dissolution of these countries isn't just driven entirely by water. It's sort of like these water shortages push things over the edge. So, you know, here in California where, you know, we went through four record years of drought, there wasn't a coup. We didn't overthrow Governor Jerry Brown. But in these countries, and what the U.S. Embassy was being told is things were all there. The Syria was already under a tremendous amount of pressures. They were dealing with an influx of refugees from Iraq. There were other issues, and they were then now dealing with running out of water. And it was, you know, the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. And it helped push the country into, and Thomas Friedman has actually done reporting on this for the New York Times, where he's went in and he's talked to farmers and he said, and that are now fighting for the rebels. And he said, well, you know, what happened? And they said, we ran out of water. Groundwater was dropping deeper and deeper and deeper. And Bashar was only allowing essentially, according to reports, his cronies to dig and chase the water down. And so when farmers would build illegal wells so that they could get access to it, he would imprison them. People were reportedly getting tortured. And now you have a million farmers that are being displaced because they don't have access to water, moving into the cities. They're angry. Food prices are going up. The population's angry. And you can just see it's a powder keg.
And so why aren't we hearing more about the link between climate change and these horrific conflicts? I mean, like you said, it's not just water, but that has contributed greatly to it and in some ways pushed these countries over the edge.
Well, you know, the climate change connection is definitely there. Nestle put it in its, you know, memo to the government and in the secret document that it is one of the three kind of contributing factors. But that said, it's very difficult to take climate change and ascribe it to a specific event, right? Because it's happening on such a grand scale and it's changing year by year that it's difficult to say this single event is resulting from climate change. And so I think that's sometimes why it's difficult to get the public to pay attention to it because it is so gradual and it's difficult to pin it on one single thing. But it's not just climate change that's driving this. Nestle put out sort of the other two things. One is that the world's population continues to grow. We're going to be at 9 billion people, they project, by 2050. And then the third one is meat consumption. And Nestle basically said if the rest of the world ate like Americans do in terms of, you know, being us in Australia eat the most meat, you know, per person in the world, we would have run out of water 15 years ago. So it's meat consumption is playing a big part in this too.
And that's amazing. So Nestle is the largest food company in the world. And where is it getting its information?
Well, the person that was talking to the U.S. Embassy in these secret documents was their chief economist. And so they have all of these metrics, and they put some of them in the document just on how much water there is total in the world on a given year for humans to access and how much water is currently being used. And so what our current sort of surplus is. And then they said, how much water would it take if everybody ate like Americans? Because we eat more than 3,000 calories. A large percentage of that is being driven by meat. And it takes 10 times as much water to produce a calorie of meat than it does a non-meat food product. So it's just, you know, there's this magnitude effect.
We're going to talk about that more later in the show, but let's step back here for a minute. Noah, we did so many shows about the drought in California last year. We did something like 2-week-long series and then shows just throughout the year. And there are so many layers to the California drought, let alone a global water crisis. So how do you explain this to citizens so we can actually wrap our head around what a global water crisis actually means?
Well, I think this is a really good question for answering your earlier question about the role of climate change in these kinds of events. And you know, so in my research group, we spent a lot of time trying to objectively analyze whether or not global warming is influencing particular extreme climate events. And the reality is that as a scientific community, we've come a long way over the last decade. We actually are now able to test whether an event like the California drought, like the drought in Syria, like the high ocean temperatures in the Great Barrier Reef that are causing coral bleaching right now, we actually can test whether or not those individual events have been influenced by global warming. Where it gets much more complicated is asking whether or not the migration in the Middle East into Europe, if that's caused by global warming. That's where it gets much more complicated when we're looking at these complex human systems. But in terms of the physical climate, we actually can ask those questions and get scientific answers. So with the California drought, we spent a lot of time during this drought trying to understand that event. We actually do know that this is the most severe drought in California's recorded history in terms of our direct observations of the climate system. We have about 120 years of climate observations. This is the most severe drought. We've set a number of records, not only the most severe drought measures, but also the highest temperatures, the lowest calendar year precipitation, the warmest winter temperatures, the lowest snowpack. All kinds of records have been set during this drought, and we know that that the very high temperatures have both made the drought more severe and they've made this level of drought more probable. And we also have very high confidence that warming of California over the long term has been due to human emission of greenhouse gases. And one way you can think about this is the way I talk about it is like if you have two different coins. One is a precipitation coin and one is a temperature coin. And it used to be in California's history that they both were true coins. They both came up tails about half the time and heads about half the time. So half the years were warm, half the years were cool, half the years were wet, half the years were dry. And what's happened because of global warming is that now the temperature coin in California is coming up tails more and more. In the last 20 years, 80% have been warm years. And we're headed towards a California that has 100% of warm years. So if you think about having a coin that flips tails 8 out of 10 times, 10 out of 10 times, then we're just much more likely to get two tails. We're much more likely to get low precipitation coinciding with high temperature. And when that happens, we have a much higher risk of drought conditions.
Noah Diffenbaugh is associate professor at Stanford. He studies the climate system, including impacts on agriculture, water resources, and human health. And Nathan Halverson is an Emmy Award-winning reporter and producer for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. He covers the global food system, business, finance, and the global water crisis. And if you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have specifically about the global water crisis? And I really want to try to figure out how we can make sense of this, because some of these issues, when you're talking about the drought, there's so many levels and layers to these issues. So what questions do you have about this? We'll also talk about solutions, political will, why this is happening. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Nathan, as a reporter, sometimes it can be difficult to explain why this is happening in scientific terms to the public. But what's interesting is when you got your hands on these cables, it's almost like that brings it to another level, because you have government officials admitting that this is a real problem behind the scenes. They might not be talking about it to the public directly, but they're talking about it with each other.
Right. That's kind of what's fascinating here. It's not a bunch of radical San Franciscan vegans shopping at Rainbow. This is the U.S. intelligence community. This is the world's largest food company saying meat consumption is driving the world into an unsustainable place.
And the radical vegans have been saying that for a while, but now the officials are saying what they've been saying.
Yeah. They're saying very explicitly the global food system is broken, that we're heading towards disaster that's going to lead to starvations of millions, tens of hundreds of millions of people. It's a really dire situation that we're headed towards, but it's also a problem that has an engineering solution. Part of it is a reduction in meat consumption in countries like the United States. Part of it is implementing good governance that puts in place more sustainable use of our water. And I guess compared to climate change, which is driven by emissions, you know, as an individual, it takes a lot of investment in capital infrastructure to begin to deal with moving away from fossil fuels to more renewable energies. But with this particular issue, what they're saying is you can begin every day changing your habits and eating less meat, and it's going to help overall in a global system help the world deal with these looming freshwater shortages.
Okay, so if you have the world's largest food company, Nestle, telling U.S. officials that the world is on a collision course with doom, that comes from Nestle, those words?
No, I don't think so.
Is your report.
Not collision course with doom, but what they say is they think one-third of the world's population will be affected by freshwater scarcity within 10 years. The situation is only going to become more dire thereafter, and they call it, quote, potentially catastrophic by 2050.
So these are words from Nestle, the largest food company in the world, and they say that this is happening because, as you know, farmers use tons of crops like corn and soy to feed cows, for example. That requires tens of thousands of gallons of water to grow, and a lot of various food advocacy groups say it'd be better if humans actually ate that, not the animals. All right, so if Nestle is telling U.S. officials this information, why aren't U.S. officials talking about this to the public? You go on savewater.org, the California Save Our Water website, there's not one mention of food. It's all about lawns and taking shorter showers.
Well, my short answer to that is I don't know what's driving them. What I can say is in talking with officials, obviously, when California's Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, SGMA, was put in place a couple years ago, it was considered a big boon because a lot of people didn't think they'd be able to get it in place because the agricultural interests are very powerful in the state, and they push back really hard. So, you know, I think that is a powerful political lobby. But again, I think through good governance in the past, we've been able to come to consensus and find solutions that both are economically strong and viable, but then are also creating a sustainable environment for our species to continue.
And how did you find out that Nestle spoke to U.S. officials about meat consumption and these issues?
I dug for a long time around through the WikiLeaks cables.
And what are your thoughts about this, NOAA? Nestle saying that the planet would have run out of fresh water 15 years ago if the rest of the world ate as much meat as Americans.
Well, as was described earlier, you know, that's presumably based on a kind of a mass balance, you know, adding up the per capita consumption and multiplying times the number of people. I think that the broader issue again is that we're using the same resource in terms of the amount of fresh water in a given place for a number of different very worthwhile activities. So if you look at a place like California, where we have one of the biggest economies in the world, we have one of the most important agricultural industries in the world, we have the largest population of any state in the union, we have incredibly diverse ecosystems both on land and in the coastal ocean, and all of those depend on fresh water. And we've actually made great strides in California over the last 30 or 40 years since the mid-70s drought in terms of improving efficiency. Our population has grown substantially. The total water use has been pretty constant, so we've improved efficiency tremendously. As was just mentioned, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act is going to help to move that progress into the area of groundwater. Our groundwater has been unregulated and largely unmeasured in many places, and now the SGMA is going to give us about 25 years to reach sustainability in terms of groundwater extraction. There's argument about that time frame and whether or not that time frame is too fast or too slow, but we now do have a framework in place to for throughout California to understand how much groundwater is there and help to create a framework for reaching sustainable extraction. If we look across the world, there are a number of other areas that are withdrawing their groundwater very quickly. In India, in the Gangetic Plains, for instance, where you have the highest population densities in the world, essentially, and a lot of agricultural activity, and there are really rapid rates of groundwater withdrawal there.
Let's take a quick call before we have to go to break. We have a number of callers on the line. Let's go to Sanjay in Fremont. Hi, Sanjay. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I had a comment. So I know it's very complicated to change farmers' rules. There needs to be political will. But I find that there are simple things to do that people actually don't do. And I think this is because the people running in these water boards are actually incompetent and they don't want to look for simple solutions. An example of this is, for example, in the Colorado River, which is a state next to California, and I wouldn't be surprised if similar things are happening in California. They have a use it or lose it policy for farmers. So if farmers don't use up the water they're going to get next year will be reduced. A lot of what farmers do is they overwater the alfalfa sprouts, which they use for cattle to ship to other parts of, to feed cattle in other parts of the USA.
Right.
But even during the drought season, they didn't even put a hold on the use it or lose it and tell farmers, okay, we're not trying to take water away from you. We're going to let you get the millions of gallons, but during this 2 years, we're going to say, please, the use it or lose it doesn't apply, so please cut down your consumption. Don't overwater your alfalfa sprouts. Even simple things like that are not being done. Okay, so how the hell are we going to actually do something like change things that require, a political change? So I'm just surprised. I bet you there are a whole bunch of small things like that that are not even being done.
Yeah, Sanjay, you make a very good point. We talked about that a lot during our drought series. Nathan?
Yeah, he makes a very good point.
Can you explain the use it or use it
Sure.
For people who aren't familiar with it?
Well, a little bit. It's not my exact area of expertise, but basically the way the water laws that exist in this country and in various states are like 100 years old. And so they were based on a time when populations were much smaller and water use was much different. And so basically it said, you know, you can have access to this much water, but if you're not using it, you know, you don't get to keep it. And so now what you have is farmers are basically in a year where they might want to fallow their fields, where crop prices might drop, where they might make more economically sensible decisions with the water. They're basically put in a position where they have to take that water and they just have to use it. Or the next year when they might want it, they don't get it. And so it leads many people criticized to poor use of water. And there are a lot of laws on the books that are likewise, you know, 100 years old that haven't been updated because to update them, it takes a great amount of political will to push through and deal with the various lobbying groups. And so far, we haven't seen our leaders and the people we elect push that stuff through.
Well, thank you for the question, Sanjay.
One more thought on that road.
Sure.
You know, Australia is often held out as an example of a place that California can learn from, other areas of the world can learn from, and they did make a lot of progress in kind of remaking their water management system during the millennium drought here in the early 2000s. And it's important to keep in mind when looking at that example that they weren't able to just wave a magic wand over the whole system and have people give up their rights. So they actually did basically buy people out of their rights in order to remake the regulations. And so, the flip side of kind of seeing all these possible sensible solutions is that we do have a system in this country where we do have legal rights and the value of land and for example, it's very much for agricultural land is very much tied to the water rights, here in the West. And so, there is a balance, in order to get that political buy-in. And again, the SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, is an example of a solution within those constraints.
Nathan.
And I'd add one more thing. I mean, when we're talking about rejiggering our agricultural system, we shouldn't be taking it lightly. This is a really complicated, as Noah is saying, but also when you get it wrong, it goes really bad. I mean, you look at what Mao Zedong did in China in the late 50s, it led to the Great Famine where he was trying to essentially retool their agrarian system. And, estimates are 37 million people starved to death because it didn't go right. So, it's both difficult to do and you really got to stick the landing.
Nathan Halverson is an Emmy Award-winning reporter and producer for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, and Noah Diffenbaugh is associate professor at Stanford. Today we are talking about the global water crisis, and this is all connected. After the break, we will talk about why Saudi Arabia's largest dairy company, Al Maray, is pumping billions of gallons of water in the Arizona desert to grow hay that it then exports back to the Middle East. So this is all very connected. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in today's conversation on Your Call. On the telephone, sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to yourcallradio.org, the website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, you may call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up in a half an hour here on KLW, it's BBC World Have Your Say. Residents are coming back to Fort McMurray, Alberta after that big wildfire. BBC World Have Your Say will tell you all about it. 11 o'clock, half hour from now here on 91.7.
The This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about sexism plaguing women in sports. Women's sports only receive 4%, just 4% of all sports media coverage, but they represent 40% of all sports participants. We're going to talk about a new documentary, It Ain't Pretty, which explores the challenges women surfers face in a male-dominated sport. What will it take for women athletes to be taken seriously? That is tomorrow. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. We will be discussing coverage of the California primary, which is on June 7th. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the global water crisis. The Center for Investigative Reporting got its hands on classified U.S. cables about this crisis. Conversations between American diplomats reveal how the growing water crisis in the Middle East contributed to the civil wars we are now seeing in Syria and Yemen. And those water shortages are also spreading to the United States. The center also reports that in private, Nestle, the world's largest food company, told U.S. officials that the world is on a collision course because Americans just eat too much meat. They say that this is not sustainable. So what questions do you have about this? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Dr. Paul in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi. Sometimes real simple solutions that are not obvious actually work better. What most of the world is doing right now is building 100-panel solar-powered houses, which eliminates gas, oil, coal. And there's probably 300,000 of these built now in Europe. Germany started it, but I'm building one in Alameda. Each 100-panel solar house generates about $1,000 a month here in California because the PUC is required to utilities to pay 15 cents a kilowatt hour, and the state of Maine requires utilities to pay 33 cents. So this income is shifting energy around the world right now from the oil companies to the homeowners. So within not a very few years, homeowners will be generating most of the energy of each town and city. That may seem hard to believe, but in Germany already, there's over 111 towns that are at 400% generating more energy than the whole town needs. They're selling it off throughout Germany, and that's why Germany today is that 90% of its energy comes from solar, wind, and hydro.
Well, thank you for calling in, Dr. Paul. We'll get a comment in just a minute, but we have a related caller. Let's hear from Harvey in Berkeley. Hi, Harvey. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Well, yes, it turns out that fossil fuel industry, coal, natural gas, and nuclear are second only to agriculture in their daily use of our America's freshwater resources. And solar panels, once manufactured and installed, use no water over their 20 to 25-year warranted lifetime. So I think that we should have a solar water credit that's given to people who put solar panels on their house to save water and slow down the effects of drought.
Thank you. There is a story in the American Prospect called California Continues to Make Big Strides on Solar. Building on a foundation of pioneering green policy, a new bill would make rooftop solar affordable for thousands more Californians. And Nathan, what has your reporting revealed about solar?
Well, I haven't done a whole lot of reporting on solar, and I love we got the solar lobby calling in here. But the fact is yeah, it's actually a little known stat that energy producers use a lot of water. Yeah. Here in California, a lot of that water is ocean water. We pull it in from the ocean, but it's used, you know, to cool the plants. It's used in the turbines, and it's a huge consumer. But in the middle, you know, in states like Arizona, where you don't have access to salt water, they're using fresh water. And so it is true that energy consumption is a really large user of water in this country and elsewhere.
A recent study by the National Renewable Energy Foundation found that up to 74% of California's total electricity usage could be generated by rooftop solar power. The state only derives 2.4% right now from solar systems. So there's a lot of room for growth here. Do you see this happening, Noah?
Well, yeah, I think the main theme that we heard in those calls is you know, the accurate pricing of water and other natural resources. And you know, my economist colleagues will be, you know, quick to tell us that if we want the behavior to reflect the real value of resources, then those resources need to be priced appropriately. And the pricing the water accurately, the full cost it will tend to create more efficiency.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. Let's go next to Alexandra in San Francisco. Hi, Alexandra. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a question. I heard recently that the water rights are given to people many, many years ago, and it's a very political thing. And the people that do have those water rights control a lot. And in California, can you comment on that? Because I hadn't known about it before I heard about it 2 weeks ago.
Yes, we've done shows about that, Nathan.
Yeah, it's not exactly my expertise, but I mean, the caller's correct. Water rights were given they run on seniority basis, so people that have had access to the water for a longer period of time get to hold on to it, and trying to change that system leads to lawsuits and is very politically contentious.
Do you have anything to add on that, Noah?
Well, yeah, and this is what I was trying to articulate earlier about the governance, that you know it's not the people that hold the rights, it's the property. Those water rights are tied to the property, and the caller is absolutely right that they, you know, in some cases those go back 150 years, and the allocations are based on seniority. And the value of land, just like in some, you know, for residential areas, the value of land might be tied to the view or the the access proximity to different school systems or et cetera, the value of agricultural land is tied to the seniority of the water rights, and that is part of what creates inertia against having a different system, right? As I was saying earlier, when they remade that management system in Australia, they weren't able to the government wasn't able to just say, now you lose all your rights, right? They had to come up with a political solution and an economic solution that the stakeholders were able to buy into.
All right. Thank you for that, Alexandra. If you want more information on that issue, if you just go to KALW.org and search drought, we did an entire show about water rights and how that works in California. It's pretty easy to find. If you have any problems, just email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thanks for calling. Let's go next to Raphael in Newark. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi. I was listening to your program and, what I was thinking is you can engineer yourself all the way to the last drop of water. You know, it seems like it's putting a Band-Aid on the thing, and you guys aren't talking about the elephant in the room. Because, you know, like you said, the gentleman said about Mousy Tung and trying to re-engineer the agricultural system in China, and eventually 35 million people died. I mean, you're going to engineer yourself into the situation where that's going to happen worldwide. You know, and the thing is that nobody's talking about the fact that we have too many people and the resources eventually are going to go away one way or another. And, you know, it's like, why isn't anybody talking about that?
All right, Noah, what do you think? The growing population.
Well, I mean, there's no question that, providing for the, 7 billion people and growing and the world's ecosystems and doing that within, an equitable framework, that's a challenge. I heard somebody say recently that, the real problem is that there are 100 times too many people on planet Earth. And frankly, I think that's not really a very practical perspective. It's not going to lead us to a solution. The reality is that we do have a large human population. We have a growing human population, and we have a lot that we've learned about how to provide for people and the environment within constrained resources. We have a lot of human ingenuity. We have done it successfully in places, and the question is, how can we, for the population that we have and the growing population that we're going to continue to have in the coming decades, how do we make the smartest, most innovative decisions that meet the needs of the world's human population and help to preserve the natural ecosystem?
Ron just wrote in a similar question. How can the media be encouraged to help educate the easily manipulated masses about the intersection and exponential effects of an exploding population, overconsumption, especially animal products, the false god of never-ending economic growth, environmental catastrophe, and political instability?
The question about consumption is important, and you know, particularly if you look at greenhouse gas emissions, for example. If we imagine a world with 9 billion people all living like we do here in America in terms of our per capita energy consumption, the real issue is actually consumption rather than population growth. And in fact, it's about a factor of 8. Elevating everybody to have the consumption of Americans actually would be 8 times as much the increase in greenhouse gas emissions as just the population growth that the UN projects. So really, I think that there's no question that in terms of resource availability, population matters, right? The more people there are, the more their demand there is for resources. But the difference in consumption, whether it's energy consumption, whether it's water consumption, the difference in per capita energy consumption between me, you know, an average American, and most of the rest of the world is just huge.
Yeah, Noah's right. It's a really morally challenging argument to tell a Nigerian to have less kids if you're American. Because, for instance, there's actually enough calories produced in the world right now to feed 12 billion people. The challenge is the amount of those calories that are going to feed animals, to feed us. And Americans are on top of the list when it comes to meat consumption. And now India and China, with their growing middle classes, are beginning to consume more meat, kind of pick up along more of a Western diet. And that's why we're seeing it does come down to largely to consumption.
And that's why Nestle is talking with U.S. officials about the consequences of meat consumption. I'm glad you brought this up because just recently, the Washington Post, a number of media outlets, reported on an updated set of dietary guidelines just released by the Chinese government. They're basically asking their citizens to eat less meat. I mean, a lot of people were kind of surprised by this because you're not seeing that in the United States.
Yeah, China has the incredible capacity to just pump out directions to its population. I mean, China's population was once booming, and although it's still slightly growing, it is expected to begin to even decline within, I think, a decade. So the Chinese government has found ways to deal with some of the problems that we're talking about. They're reducing, from what I understand, their use of coal. Or slowing it anyways. They're now telling their population to eat less meat, and they've stabilized their population growth.
In the Washington Post, Marco Springman of the University of Oxford had a study that found reducing China's average meat consumption by 100 grams a day in the year 2050 could help avert 2.2 million deaths and cut food-related greenhouse gas emissions by more than a billion metric tons. Can you make sense of that for us? Is that a really big deal?
Yeah. I mean, China's got, a fifth of the world's population. So anything that they do that's going to be reducing output of greenhouse gas emissions, you know, methane, which is released from cows and other livestock, is going to have a positive impact. And in particular, methane, it sticks around the atmosphere for a shorter period of time. So if you reduce methane, you can actually see probably a quicker impact on climate change.
And again, Nathan at the Center for Investigative Reporting got his hands on some documents from WikiLeaks showing that Nestle, the world's largest food company, has told U.S. officials that Americans just eat too much meat and this is not sustainable. If everyone around the world ate like Americans, the planet would have run out of water 15 years ago, fresh water. And we have a question from Philip about this. He wants to know why these Nestle findings were classified as secret. Why isn't this public?
A lot of this stuff was just classified under U.S. cables. These things were being sent to the State Department, to the CIA. They were internal documents. They were candid conversations. It's a great question. Why aren't we having this conversation more in public? Fortunately, we now are. And I think what everyone seems to be saying is that, you know, to get the political will, to get the necessary changes, we're going to have these conversations in public.
What is the status of the other story you revealed about Al Mare, Saudi Arabia's largest dairy company? It says it's pumping up billions of gallons of water in the Arizona desert to grow hay that it then exports back to the Middle East. This is called virtual water. They say it's more effective to use the Arizona water to irrigate land and ship the hay to Saudi Arabia rather than filling a fleet of oil tankers with water. I mean, do some countries actually do that?
No, because it's not efficient.
Okay.
What they do is they grow the crops here and then they ship it back. We're beginning to see cracks in the system. We're beginning to see a domino effect. The Nestle cable, the Nestle is really clear on what areas are going to be hit hardest: India, China, Middle East, and the Western United States. And we really saw these massive freshwater shortages hitting the Middle East first. You know, you saw the political instability ramifications in Syria and Yemen. And, you know, who saw them before us was King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. So around the late 2000s, he's telling U.S. officials that they need to solve this for political stability reasons. He actually decrees that 2016 will be the last year his country ever grows wheat. At one time in the 90s, because they were pumping up so much groundwater, they were the world's sixth largest exporter of wheat, but they've run out of groundwater. So now they're having to go overseas essentially to find water. But you don't ship water back in oil containers or in vessels. What you do is you go to the Arizona desert, which is what they've done. And this is like Arizona desert that looks like Wile E. Coyote, you know, just classic desert. They found a place where the groundwater's not regulated. They can pump up as much as they want. They grow alfalfa hay all year long. They get about 14 tons per acre. And then they've developed new technology where they take the bales of hay and they compress them really small. They load them up into 18-wheelers. They drive them to Long Beach. They put them on shipping vessels and they ship it back to Riyadh. I mean, that's how we transfer water around the world.
And this is for dairy cows?
These are for dairy cows in the Middle East.
And then that milk is shipped around the Middle East?
Yeah. It's the Middle East's largest dairy company.
Wow. What is the status of the same thing happening with China? Because that got a lot of attention a couple years ago about alfalfa being grown in California and then sent back to China.
Oh, it's the exact same thing. That's
it's still happening.
Yeah, China. I wrote about, and this is, you know, 2 years ago, I was focused on Asian organized crime and the casino industry. And then I was asked to look at the largest ever Chinese purchase of an American company, which was Shuangwei, China's largest meat company, buying Smithfield Foods, which is the world's largest pork company in Smithfield, Virginia. And as I dug deeper and I traveled to China, what became clear is that the Chinese government was behind the deal. They were foreseeing their water shortages. They want to make sure that their population has access to meat. So they have come over here and purchased meat. And, you know, I mean, the Saudis are shipping hay back, but an even more efficient way to ship water is to take the hay here and give it to the animal and then ship back dairy or ship back, you know, pork loins, because that's even a higher concentration of water. And so that's what we're beginning to see.
So make sense of this. On one hand, the Chinese government is telling citizens don't eat as much meat. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they now own the largest pork producer in the United States, where they actually slaughter one pig every second, right? You also found out that information. So how do you – what are your thoughts on those two?
Well, I mean, they're a one-party system, so they have, you know, they have to always, you know, they're what the former head of Goldman Sachs for Greater China told me, who's, you know, well connected to the party. He said they're a one-party system. They need to keep people happy. This is part of their setup, and so they're making sure that people have access to as much meat as they want. But then they're also being, you know, being their style of governance. They're saying, okay, folks, you need to eat less meat, or we need to cool down the meat consumption.
And we've got about a minute left. What, when you're talking to politicians or people who admit that we're on the wrong course here, what changes are they fighting for?
Well, I think the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act was the big fight of recent years. I think, as Noah said, you know, the now that people are looking at it and saying, is 25 years to get these aquifers in a sustainable status too long a time horizon. I think that's sort of the thing that's being volleyed about now.
And just briefly, Noah, what about you? What changes would you like to see?
Well, you know, I've been really impressed with, you know, the example that California has set, not only in, you know, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, but also in terms of dealing with this drought and both getting through a difficult situation and setting us up for greater resilience in the future. The SGMA, the Groundwater Act, is a part of that, and it's an important part. I mean, I think, you know, we can continue to try to find other sources of supply and storage to take the pressure off groundwater, to take the pressure off our reliance on snow as that resource dwindles, whether it's storing stormwater or, you know, desalination is technology a lot of people talk about. But certainly there's always efficiency, just like with energy. People say that, you know, the cheapest energy is the cheapest watt is the watt you don't use, and that goes for water as well. There's a lot of room for efficiency as well.
Noah Diffenbaugh is associate professor at Stanford, and Nathan Halverson is an Emmy Award-winning reporter and producer for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the sexism plaguing women in sports. Women's sports only receive 4% of all sports media coverage, despite representing 40% of all sport participants. A new documentary, It Ain't Pretty, explores the challenges women surfers face in a male-dominated sport. So what will it take for women athletes to be taken seriously? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.